Now we're going to talk about rejecting quite a lot of what's involved in modern life. That's me in the corner. That's me in the spotlight. Losing my religion. Trying to keep up with you. And I don't know if I can do it. A song that R.E.M. said wasn't in fact about losing your religion. That's a Southern American expression, evidently, for being at the end of your tether. And that's where our next guest comes in. She was at the end of hers. Nihilism gets a bad rap. It always has done, this uncomfortable claim that there's not much point to anything. But Wendy Seifert says that is the point. We live in a chaotic world. We try and wrest meaning out of it. Most of that meaning under scrutiny is meaningless. She's written The Sunny Nihilist, How a Meaningless Life Can Make You Truly Happy. It's a book in many ways aimed at a young demographic plagued by pressures over uncertain futures and mistrustful of institutions and not satisfied with the bright facades of TikTok and Instagram. So let's find out what her version of nihilism is, seeing as she recommends it highly. Wendy Seifert is a journalist based in Melbourne. She's won a number of awards. She's currently editor-in-chief of Rise, an online sustainable magazine. She used to be the managing editor of Vice Asia and the head of editorial for it as well. She's written for The Guardian, the ABC, British Vogue, the Boston Globe. It's a long list. Hello, Wendy.
Hi, how are you going?
Very well. We are driven to always find meaning. We feel shame or guilt when we don't. So much of our experience is imbued with fake meaning now. Let's forget that. Celebrate our lives as we are. There's magic in them. We just don't have time to see until we step outside the paradigms they fob off on us. As a description of your book, you know, Between Flaws and a Lift, how does that sound?
I mean, I think that was pretty spot on, to be honest. I wish I could have borrowed it for the blurb. I needed you 18 months ago.
Well, for the second and third editions, that'll be quite possible.
Exactly.
Love to have my name in a book. So what is nihilism in your view, and what's the version of it you recommend, please?
Life has no meaning. Nothing matters. Everything is just chaos and it just exists. You know, God, work, love, family, anything that you use to kind of like create parameters of what a life is or should be is just a complete construct that we kind of create to comfort ourselves, which I admit sounds kind of like a huge bummer and that's pretty terrifying. But what I have kind of come to see nihilism as is maybe less a completely like enveloping theory and more of a tool, how nihilism can be kind of a weapon against our obsession with meaning in modern day life, and particularly the way that our very human and very understandable desire to find meaning in our life can be kind of commodified and sold to us and used as a way to sort of like manipulate us and tell us what our lives are supposed to look like and how we're supposed to be happy. But in reality, I think if we actually sat down and examined a lot of these systems that we've fallen into, we might find they just make us feel more miserable and more lost and more alone than maybe gazing into the abyss in the first place would have.
Yes, you're a sunny nihilist. We'll get to aspects of that, but it's hard to get past the word, and nihilism's always frightened me, and I always associate it with Mrs. Moore entering the caves of Marabar in the E.M. Forster novel A Passage to India, and I'm not the world's most widely read person, but we studied that at uni, and she goes into the caves, a kind and generous and purposeful sort of woman, and when she emerges, her whole belief system has become meaningless, and I'm sure that prospect makes many of us shudder were we to lose our bearings in that way. So there is bad nihilism as well as your sunny nihilism, isn't there? That's the problem.
Yeah, I could kind of call it toxic nihilism. I feel like with most philosophies, they're basically pretty neutral, but humans will kind of put into them and take out of them whatever they want.
What was your own transformation, though? Because this book has emerged from your own busy, bustling background. You know all about marketing. You're in the savvy commercial world. But a noisy anxiety, I think I'm quoting, began to swell in you. What happened?
Yeah, I mean, I'm very much part of what I think we will look back on as generation burnout. I was obsessed with my job. put everything into it. It was a complete definer of my life. I'd been told that my work was important, that I was important because of the work I did, that everything was like sort of so vital and, you know, you're changing the world. And it became a way to really exploit me. It's, you don't need to pay someone as much when you tell them that they're important. It becomes like, meaning becomes this kind of like very thin currency that you can pass over to people that sort of distracts them from actually saying, oh, wait a second, like, why am I working 14 hours a day and earning what I earned as a waitress?
Because you're important.
Yeah, exactly. Because I have to, because the newsletter I send out on Wednesdays is changing the world or whatever. And I think I very much fell into this trap. And then I talk about this in the book, but one day I was walking home and, you know, my stress levels were just next level. Like I wasn't sleeping. I could barely eat. I was so miserable. At a level of stress that you would think would be associated to someone who was very important, which I really have to stress, I was not. And I was walking home one day, just literally on the edge of a panic attack, like thinking I've got to get through the door before I actually collapse. Like I can't breathe. And I just had this thought just popped into my head. Oh my God, who cares? One day you're going to be dead. And like, no one is going to remember any of the things you're supposed to complete today. No one's going to remember you. No one's going to remember this presentation or this article or this assignment. This is all just like going to disappear one day and none of it matters. And as I said, it sounds like it's grim, but I was shocked to be just completely overwhelmed by this sense of calm and freedom and peace.
You're definitely happier now that stayed with you.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I used to say it was the defining point of my life, but then I had a baby. So I guess it's the second defining point of my life.
Yeah, I want to ask you about the baby. But in your current and future employment, is there a danger that you'll be thought of as the woman who doesn't care too much about towing the company line? Because in the end, all the hoops we're asked to jump through are a bit meaningless.
I think we become really fixated on meaning and we get meaning and value confused. And something I say is, I think things are meaningless, but I do believe things have value. So your job has value. Someone is paying you for it. You should respect them. You know, you have made an agreement to do a job for a certain amount of time. You come to it with, again, a level of respect and kind of commitment. And then you expect from your employer to give you back, again, that level of support, commitment, and hopefully a livable wage. And I think when you actually take meaning out of it, it can make that exchange feel a lot clearer and a lot more respectful. I think it's made me a better manager and probably a better employee.
Yeah, you're more relaxed. You've laid back a bit. But as you say, we are compelled to give value. And if we do that, if we enter into those contracts, we still have to get out of bed in the morning and put our socks and shoes on and walk out into the world and do things. It's just that we shouldn't be fooled into thinking what we do is tied to some giant narrative. But how good are people, Wendy, do you think, at that level of autonomy? And how well would society function without the level of regulation we're accustomed to?
Yeah, I mean, I think that, like, I'm not all for let's go full anarchist and just let anything happen. And something I kind of say about nihilism, in my experience, is it can often make the world feel very big and very small. So the smallness is kind of easy to grasp. It's this idea of, you know, if nothing matters, if, I mean, I personally, not tied to religion, I'm not kind of like thinking about the afterlife, I'm not really tied to big ideas about what romantic partnership looks like or what my body or my brain or my living room decor is supposed to look like. It kind of returns you to yourself. So it lets you think in the moment, okay, well, what right now is making me happy? What is valuable? What do I need to protect and cherish and spend time thinking about? And that might be managing to drink this cup of coffee before it gets cold. It might be spending time with someone you love. It might be eating a perfect peach on a summer day. When it's not just about validating your own ego, you start thinking, okay, well, what else has value to me? What else might not be like meaningful in this like very romantic sense of the world, but has something that I want to protect and treasure? For me, I'm very interested in environmental activism. To me, the protection of the planet, community engagement around those issues, that's something where I'm like, this is bigger than myself. It's more important than myself. I can focus on this beyond myself. For other people, that might be their family. It might be their community, their neighborhood. It might be the preservation of refugee rights for people, protecting the vulnerable. I think it just kind of clears away the amount of energy in your brain that is just completely focused on you. And it lets you kind of focus on something a little bit larger than yourself.
The Sunny Nihilist, How a Meaningless Life Can Make You Happy. And we're talking with Wendy Seifert. So let's go with your idea that all the scaffold, not all the scaffolding, but a lot of the scaffolding that supports our lives, love and marriage and government and jobs and buying beach houses and clothes and iPhones and partying and, in fact, anything that typically engrosses many of us. Let's go with the fact that it's illusory, different ways of avoiding, you know, a great truth we don't want to be jolted by. How come so many people get deep satisfaction, or at the very least happiness and thrills, you know, from a lot of the endeavors you might consider smoke and mirrors?
Well, I mean, I would argue how many people are really made that happy by these things. I mean, I'm sure there are people out there who look at their $4 million house and their, you know, 80-hour working week and kind of sigh, take a big sigh and say, love it, perfect, like made me happy. and I mean, good for them. But I would say that I think for most people, if you really stopped and you like just took a breath for a second and you thought, what really, really makes me feel like that deep sense of peace and happiness in your heart? I always think that feeling you get on holiday when you can kind of like, you feel something kind of lifting off you and you feel like you're your true self and you're most relaxed.
Yeah.
And it's like, what's actually delivering that? It's not the $1,500 you spend on plane tickets. It's not the $9 cocktail you got at the swim up bar. It's probably the time you're spending with your partner. It's probably sleeping in. It's probably not looking at your phone every 20 minutes. They're not these things that you have to spend the next 30 years like trying to chase. It's the stuff you could probably walk into your kitchen or walk up to your, text your best friend and kind of like grasp right now. But we have been kind of conditioned to disregard.
When you phrase it like that, it's very hard to argue with, but you do say that all systems of meaning and purpose that are foisted on us are effectively made up. So this is predicated, isn't it, your thesis in the book, on having to be either an atheist, which you are, or a Buddhist?
I kind of again see it as something you can kind of move through and pick up and take parts and take pieces of. And you might look at this and say, yeah, I want to be more mindful and thoughtful and really like put my energy into appreciating the time I spend with my child as opposed to like the amount of emails I write. But I take a great amount of pleasure from prayer or from exercise or from watching beauty YouTube channels. And to that I say, like, I'm not here to yuck anyone's yum or judge anyone. If you are finding like true peace and happiness in these spaces, then like, please don't throw the baby out with the bathwater.
I do like your observation that we seem to be in an era of peak meaning involving lots of hyperbole. You know, things are transformative when they're not much, or they're shockingly egregious when they aren't often. And people are finding arguably meaning in many mostly meaningless conversations and basically treating their own opinion as gospel. We're in that type of milieu, aren't we?
Yeah, it's like, what was the one I was looking at the other day that always sticks with me? There was like a tampon packet and it said like, there's a revolution in this box. And I was like, there are revolutionary things about like female hygiene or the hygiene of a menstruating person. But I was like, I don't think that that's what this box of tampons is. But I think, you know, it's easy to make fun of the stuff and make jokes about it. And I spend a lot of time texting my friends stupid things I see in kind of copywriting and on Instagram ad captions and things like that. But I am really sympathetic to the fact that our desire for meaning is very, very human. Like there is a reason why pretty much every civilization has sought out some kind of understanding of spirituality or, you know, create a myth. Like we are wired to think like this. I'm not being judged. I don't want to be judgmental or dismissive of that. You know, you can't really like judge someone for just taking the shortcut. But like all shortcuts, if you take enough of them, you just kind of end up completely lost.
You're trapped in it like we are, though. On the show page online of Rise, how many ways can you wear the same garment? Six shades to shop if your wardrobe is in need of a sartorial serotonin boost. And of course, we won't care much as we die about how well we boosted our wardrobe. And some people might say these are areas you should eschew. My point is that you're making a living like the rest of us. You're compelled to give value. And it's very hard to escape that trap, whoever you are.
Yeah, exactly. And I'm like, people are going to buy clothes. People are going to look at TikTok. People are going to do these things. Again, for me, Rise, where I work, is kind of about responsible consumerism and supporting brands that are, you know, not making the world actively worse. So from my point of view, it's like, this is my job. I'd rather support a small label where a young woman is running it with her mum with hand-spun organic New Zealand wool than, you know, work for a bank and write a bunch of like fake content telling people that they can afford a house if they just stop getting the second latte every morning.
G.K. Chesterton, not often quoted these days, but I remember he said, when people stop believing in God, because there's a chapter in your book called Life After God, when people stop believing in God, they don't believe in nothing, they believe in anything. So let's replace God with your kind of scaffolding word. As bits start falling off the scaffolding, the actual effect socially isn't, well, I can't trust all the stuff, I'm going to carve out a nihilistic life and just, you know, celebrate me and smell the roses. It tends to be, oh God, I've got to find meaning here or over there, let's give that a go. Isn't that what we see in the world now? Isn't that human as well?
Yeah, 100%. I find that really interesting. I write about it in the book, but I was raised in a religious household. My parents are still religious. My sister is religious. Everyone's very respectful of each other's beliefs. I think a lot of these things give you this sense of, again, whether it's a horoscope or a biblical scripture, this sense of like a second life or a second world or a second space of like, we're just moving through this thing. And this present moment is just something we need to endure and kind of fix so we can get to the next better thing. And I think something where nihilism comes in and kind of like sits opposite that is it can kind of say to you, stop looking at like, I mean, the grass has been greener on the other side, and actually pause and be in this moment and be like, what is beautiful and special and nourishing?
But there is that old Taoist saying that those who say don't know and those who know can't say. So perhaps the real meaning in life is concealed by anonymity, because we just don't hear much from the people who've sought and found the real answers. We hear a lot from everybody else.
I know. I'm sure if you're actually completely spiritually fulfilled, you're probably not arguing with people about the stuff on Twitter. Yeah. You're just sitting in the backyard looking at your bird bath or something. I always just really think that if you take anything away from this book, it's just a way to recognize the things in your life that truly make you happy and to hold them like clearly in your hand and not let all this noise and all this kind of dogma coming from other people kind of clutter that away.
You have a new baby. Congratulations.
Thank you. Very new.
Will she make a difference maybe to the way you see the world?
You know, I look at her and I sort of think, I don't think, you know, well, what's your life going to be? What's it all going to matter? Like, what are you going to achieve? Is it going to be meaningful? Is it going to be enough? So I know when she's kind of screaming in the middle of the night and I'm sort of shushing her, and part of my brain is begging her to go to sleep and wondering if I'll ever close my eyes ever again. And another part of me is just thinking, God, I'm never going to have night 11 with this child ever again. This moment's never going to exist again. It's going to pass and disappear and be forgotten. And I just have to sit with it. So yeah, it's been an interesting experience of sort of this kind of very pure mindful nihilism that is deeply comforting, and also obviously just feeling incredibly chaotic, and just I'm Googling pictures of what a one-year-old looks like and imagining what it would be like when she's one.
You've got to sort out what school she's going to. I'm surprised you've left this so late.
Someone asked me if I had registered for creche yet, and I was just like, oh my gosh, I'm just trying to, you know, wash my hair once a week.
The years fly by. So take time to slow down, smell the roses, stay in the game, but recognize the game for what it is. Try and stay in the moment, all that stuff. That's it.
Perfect. Love it. Could have saved me a whole book with that one paragraph.
Great to talk to you. Well done on the book.
You too. Thank you so much.